Okay, well, of course, here is the place where I say the words, turn with me, if you will. In this case, it's easy to find because it's chapter 18 of the book of Genesis, or a Bereshit in the beginning. And we're actually kind of in the middle at this point of the life of the first of the patriarchs, Abram, who is now officially called Abraham. And thereafter, throughout Scripture, that's how he'll be referred to. What I think is interesting about this portion up front is the fact that we're going to see a little bit more of an insight into the character of this man. And part of the reason why, as I like to joke about it, if you look up the word chesed or kindness or hospitality in or charity, all of those words basically can be translated from chesed. In a Hebrew Bible or Scripture or whatever, you probably ought to find Abraham's picture. In any case, chapter 18 starts like this. Ve-yera, and he appeared. And appeared who? Yahuwah. Unto him, and in this case we're talking about Abraham, so it's him, by the terebinths of Mamre, as he sat in the door of the tent in the heat of the day. And he lifted up his eyes, and here were three men that were coming over. He saw them, he ran down to meet them from the tent door, and he bowed down to the earth, and he said, My Lord, Adoni, if now I have found favor in your sight, do not pass away from your servant. Let me get a little water for you. Let me get you some food. Wash your feet. Recline yourselves under a tree. I'll get you some bread. And stick around. Stay after your own heart. After that, you can head on out. But you're here to come to your servant. So they said, yeah, that sounds fine. Go ahead, do as you have said. So Abraham hastened to his tent. He told Sarah, his wife, make ready quickly 3 measures of fine meal, knead it, and make some cakes. Then he went out into the herd. He fetched himself a good and tender calf, gave it to his servant. You wonder if this is the fellow we're going to see about in the next portion or two, maybe. But it doesn't tell us here. And he hastened to go dress it. He took curd, milk, and the calf which he had dressed. Here's the point at which at least some of us will kind of jokingly say, and he made a cheeseburger. Because this is a place where it looks like, even though as a general rule, Abraham knew a whole lot about what was clean and unclean food, obviously, as did Noah before him, here he is, in fact, doing something which rabbis say now is not acceptable, which is mixing milk and meat in the same meal. So he had cheese, he had milk, and he had the calf. And he set all this before him, and he stood by under the tree, and so they ate. And here comes the place where the plot thickens. I always enjoy this because it's setting up probably, to my mind, one or two, actually, of the most poignant stories in the book. They ask him, where's your wife, Sarah? Well, she's in the tent, he said. And he said, now we're not sure who he is. The King James and the English versions usually capitalize this. And so there certainly is an implication that this might be, whether you want to call him pre-incarnate or a manifestation of the Almighty, however it is, this is certainly the most high, at least certainly most high here, and arguably Yod-Heh Vav-Heh, perhaps. Right? Again, we're not clear on that, but you'll see and hear all kinds of speculations. But whoever it is says, I will certainly return unto you when the season comes around. Look, your wife Sarah will in fact have a son. Now Sarah was standing in the tent door. She overheard this, and then there's a pause. Okay, what does she do? Well, we got to wait a second, because the Bible sees fit to remind us one more time right here. You know what? Abraham and Sarah were pretty old at this point. Well stricken in age is how it's put in the English. And it had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. In other words, sounds very much like she had entered and passed menopause. Probably not going to get pregnant anymore, in other words. So that's basically why it seems that she laughed. Says she laughed within herself. And she asked herself the following, must have been under her breath, after I'm waxed old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord also being pretty old? Now at this point, we're told, and this is part of the reason why there's perhaps resolved ambiguity here, because it says it is Yahuwah at this point who says unto Abraham, why did Sarah laugh and say, I'm an old woman, surely you buying this that I will bear a child at this age? Is anything too hard for Yahuwah? He repeats what he just finished saying. At set time, I will return to you. And when the season comes around, Sarah indeed shall have a son. Well, she denied having actually laughed and said, no, I didn't laugh, because she was afraid at this point. No, he says, you really did laugh. And the men then rose up, and they looked out towards Sodom. Abraham went with them to head them on down the road. And at this point, we have kind of what would be, if it was a play, an aside. Almost like where Yahuwah speaks to the two that were with him, and he says, shall I hide with Abraham that which I am doing? Obviously, he doesn't intend to, or he wouldn't be saying this so that it could be heard. Seeing that Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in and through him. Well, look, I have known him, he says, to the end that he may command his children and his household after him, so that they can keep my way, the way of Yahuwah, to do righteousness and justice. In other words, to follow Torah, to be Zadikim. In the end, that Yahuwah may bring upon Abraham all of that which he has spoken of him. So back at this point to the third person. And again, Yahuwah says, verily, the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and their sin is exceedingly grievous. Now, what I find interesting in this, and I'll just mention this, we're going to see this same phraseology again in just a minute. The cry of Sodom and Gomorrah. And as I was reading that this year in particular, I kind of had a different take than I have in years past. This is one of those things where, you know, based on what's going on in the world and we read Scripture, sometimes we tend to get kind of a little different insight. And I'd say this is one of those, at least to me. The cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great. Now think about that. Are they crying out in anguish, save us, save us? Are there not a whole lot of nasty people? He says their sin is exceedingly grievous. What does that mean? Their cry is great. It's almost like their wickedness, the sin. Well, remember when Cain slew Abel, we have the blood crying out from the ground. And maybe that's what he's referring to. Anyway, the reason it resonated with me is because I guess it's hard to look at the world today without thinking a little bit about Sodom and Gomorrah and wondering that, if that befell them for some wickedness that kind of seems almost tame compared to what we're seeing today, maybe. What's the cry going up from America? I am kind of suspecting that even in Sodom on the Potomac, for example, today, there are probably a few righteous people who cry out for the wickedness that's being done. You know what they say, the old joke about lawyers or other criminals? It's the 97% that give the good ones a bad name. And I'm wondering what the situation was in Sodom. So think about that. This idea of their cry is exceedingly great. Okay, well, he says, I'm going to go on down there and I'm going to see whether they have done all together according to the cry of it, which has come unto me. And if not, I'll know. So they headed on out. They went towards Sodom. Abraham, though, still stood before Yahuwah. Here comes one of those places that I call a character glimpse. It's probably the first long, extended conversation, not held at a time of chastening, as with Adam and Chava, for example, or with Cain, that we see in the Bible. Abraham is now going to do something which kind of characterizes the man in a lot of respects. He drew near. He asked a question. Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose, he said, there are 50 righteous still in that city. Would you indeed sweep away and not forgive that entire place for the 50 righteousness, that the 50 righteous ones that are still there? And far be it from you to do after this manner, slay the righteous along with the wicked. That you wouldn't do that kind of thing, would you? So that the righteous should be just like the wicked? That'd be far from you. Shall not the judge of the earth, of all of the earth even, do justly? You got to appreciate the way he approaches this. And the dickering, that's the term I've used to describe this conversation, that goes on. Well, says Yahuwah, if I in fact find 50 righteous folk within Sodom, then I will forgive the whole place for their sake. Well, says Abraham, okay, behold now, I have taken it upon myself to speak unto Yahuwah. That's interesting, isn't it? Who am I but dust and ashes? So, let's suppose, peradventure, we're just 5 short. Instead of 40, instead of 50, we have 55. Would you destroy the entire city for the lack of that 5? Nope. Says Yahuwah, I would not destroy it if I could still find 45. Well, then he spoke to him one more time. He said, well, look here. Suppose maybe there's 40 there. Nope, I won't do it for the sake of the 40. Well, okay. Let not Yahuwah be angry, he says. I will speak. Peradventure, 30. Would you go for 30? Nope, I won't do it if I find 30 there. You can see where this is headed. We already know the story, of course. What if it's 20, he says. Nope, I won't destroy it for the sake of 20. And then finally, good old Abraham says, oh, let not Yahuwah be angry. And I'll speak yet just this one more time. Peradventure, what if 10 should be found there? He's all the way down to 10. Now, this, by the way, historically has been called, this is a number that you'll hear referred to in the Hebrew, as a minion. A minion of men is 10 people. So, what if there's a minion here? 10. Says the king of all creation, I will not destroy it for the sake of the 10. So, Yahuwah went on his way. As soon as he left off speaking, and Abraham returned unto his place. And, of course, the conversation is memorialized forever. We do know the end of the story, obviously. It's not clear how many righteous are found there, but it's not 10. Chapter 19 tells about the two folks that had gone down into Sodom. They went ahead. And Lot was in the gate. He sits in the gates of Sodom. So he is basically in the position of some kind of an elder, even though he's considered to be an outsider. Lot saw them. He rose up to meet him. He fell down on his face to the earth, and he said, behold, now my lords, turn aside. Come on over to my place. Tarry all night, wash your feet, rise up early, then go on your way then. No, we're going to stay here in the broad place all night. Well, he urged them greatly. They turned into him. They entered his house. He made them a big feast, a second feast they've had. And he baked unleavened bread for them, and they ate. But before they could even lie down to take a rest, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, compassed the house. They surrounded the house, young and old, and people from every quarter. And they called out to Lot, and they said, where are the men came to you this night? Bring them out so that we might know them. Which is probably not a good thing. We understand what that word yada in this context means. It's a biblical knowledge, but it's certainly not a biblical way of doing it. Well, Lot went out. He shut the door. And he said outside to the folks, I pray you, my brethren, do not do so wickedly. Look, and this, by the way, has always bugged me. I think probably I'm not alone. Everybody that's read this probably is thinking, what is going on with this guy? And it's the subject of, as you would expect, a whole lot of speculation. It's not necessarily even true, as we're going to see. But he says, look, I got two daughters that are virgins. Trust me, I wouldn't lie to you. Pray to me. Let me, I pray you, bring them out to you. You can have your way with them. Only don't do anything to these men, because they have come under the shadow of my roof. So I guess about the closest we can come to excusing this is to say he does seem to understand that there is a moral imperative to protect the men who have come under his protection and entered into his house. On the other hand, I'm having difficulty not understanding why he wouldn't think the same thing about those people who are of his own flesh and blood, his daughters, who are also under his covering. All right, they said, stand back. This one fellow came to sojourn. He now wants to play judge. We'll do even worse to you than we intended to do to them. So, essentially, this is the place where we see they still regard him as an outsider. So they pressed upon the man to Lot, and they literally attempted to break down the door. But the men inside weren't having any of this, and they put forth their hand, brought Lot into the house to them, shut the door, and then proceeded to smite the men at the door of the house with blindness, both small and great, it says, so they couldn't even find the door. You'd think that would be enough of a kind of an indication that they maybe ought to head on home, but nope. They instead said to Lot, you got any others here? Son-in-law, sons, daughters? Bring them all out. We'll take them all. We're going to destroy this place because the cry of them is waxed great before Yahuwah, and Yahuwah has sent us to destroy it. So let's do that again. The men ask Lot. This time it's the men not outside the house, but inside the house. Son-in-law and your sons, your daughters, anybody that you've got here in the city, take them out of here because we're fixing to, you know, tear this place apart. And that's why, in fact, Yahuwah has sent us to destroy it. So, it says, Lot went out. He spoke unto his sons-in-law who married his daughters. I'm thinking this is kind of the proof text that says he was woofing them before, the men outside. Get out of this place, he says, for Yahuwah will destroy this city. But it seemed to his son-in-laws as if he was woofing them. He was kidding them. He was joking with them. Now, interestingly, this word, and I usually mention this because the word appears over and over and over again. This is literally a portion which could have the root word zachak as, like a subtitle for the entire portion. Once again, we see the root word that becomes the name of Isaac, Zachak, and it's also the thing that Sarah was caught doing, and it's also what the son-in-laws were doing, or at least thought that Lot was doing. And get this, it cost them their lives. I suspect Lot was as persuasive as he could be in the situation, but they still weren't having anything of it. They thought he was jesting with them, and he couldn't talk them out of that. That's somehow kind of sad if you think about it. This is a matter of life and death, and he can't get him to come along. Oh, funny, Dad. Okay, so the morning came up. The angels, the messengers, the malakim hastened Lot, and they said, "Get your wife, get your daughters, get them out of here, lest they be swept away with the iniquity, the Torahlessness of this city." But Lot lingered. Men finally grabbed a hold of his hand and his wife, and they literally, along with the hands of his daughters, they dragged them out of there because Yahuwah was being merciful to him. They brought him out, they set him outside the city, and it came to pass when they were outside that he was told the following: escape for your life, and don't turn around, don't look behind you, and don't stay at all in the plains. Get to the mountains or you'll be swept away. Well, Lot says to them, "Oh, no, no, not so, my lord. Behold, now, your servant, if I've found grace in your sight, and you've magnified your own mercy, which you've shown to me by saving my life, I'm thankful for that, right? And I cannot escape to the mountain, lest evil overtake me and die. Well, hey, wait, just a minute here. There's a little teeny city over there. Can't I go to that one? And my soul shall live?" And he said, "See, I've accepted you concerning this thing, too, that I will not overthrow the city of which you have spoken. So get on in there, hurry, for I can't do anything till you have come inside the city." So the name of the place was then called Zoar. And when Lot got into Zoar, the sun had risen. So basically he left early, and he is, by the time he gets to Zoar, the sun is well up. And then Yahuwah caused to rain down upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from Yahuwah out of heaven. Now, this is the week, of course, where you won't hear the press talk about it, but supposedly the bogus bombs contained a sulfur, which is basically what brimstone is. Now, this brimstone had an oxidizer with it, unlike the stuff that was in the bogus bombs, and it really did cause some major problems. So literally, sulfur and fire rains down out of Hashemayim, and it took out Sodom and Gomorrah. What's interesting, some of you have seen this, if you've ever been to the area where Sodom and Gomorrah were, or seen some things that have been brought out of there. I'm trying to think. There's been several people that I've known that have been to the land. Michael Rood was one. There are some others that have brought back genuine brimstone. This is a little sulfur, rock sulfur pellets that are pretty hard, and the entire area is covered with them. And if you've ever smelled sulfur and you smell a piece of brimstone, there's no doubt that's what you're looking at. So it says, he overthrew all those cities, the entire plain, the inhabitants of the cities, all that which grew upon the ground. Lot's wife, though, didn't listen. Now, when I was a kid, I always bothered this. She glanced back behind her, and then she turned into a pillar of salt. The image, you know, stuck with me all these years. I have a suspicion that there's more to this. The indication, to my mind, kind of seems to be, it's not just looking back, it's got to do with probably the way that she looked back. Now, if it was me, and if it was my wife, hopefully I'd have made the point clear, don't even turn your head around. All right, if you hear something coming up behind you, run, don't look back. But she, in fact, not only looked back, but the root here seems to be that she looked back with longing, perhaps. It wasn't, I don't think. This is just my the Markology part of this, that she just twisted her head a bit. But whatever happened, she became a pillar of melach, powder or salt. And of course, if you think about it, arguably what happened here is that she was reduced to the basic chemical constituents of the human body, right? She takes away the water, and that's what you got left. So it might be that that's what literally what happened. Okay, Abraham got up early in the morning to the place where he'd stood before Yahuwah. He checked out, hey, what's going on with Sodom and Gomorrah? And behold, yeah, look at that. The smoke of the land went up like a furnace. I kind of wonder if it was a mushroom cloud even. But it says like a furnace, so there's probably a lot of ways that could be done in terms of what it might look like. And it came to pass when Elohim had destroyed the cities of the plain that he remembered. He, Zakar, in the Hebrew, Abram, now Abraham, and he sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, and he overthrew the cities that Lot dwelt in. So Lot had to leave Zoar, and he went up into the mountains. His daughters with him, and he found a place to dwell in a cave along with the two daughters. Now, you know the story here, too. This is another one of those places where you look at Lot, and you're going, just what is going on with this guy? The tendency that I kind of tend sometimes to be a little bit disdainful of is of the rabbis, the sages, to try and excuse something like this and say, oh, you know, Lot was still a righteous man. Well, he might have been righteous compared to Sodom. He was righteous enough, and it might have just been because of Abraham's favor that he was taken out of there. But in any case, we're not seeing what looks like a major righteousness indicator happening here. The firstborn, the older, says to the younger daughter, our dad's getting old, and is there not a man in the earth to come into us? In other words, to impregnate us after the manner of all the earth. So, hey, let's do this. Let's get dad drunk. Let's make him drink wine, and we will, in fact, lie with him so that we can preserve the seed of our father. So they got him drunk. They made him drink wine. The firstborn went in. She lay with her father. And look at this. It says, basically, I'm going to paraphrase this. He was so out of it, he didn't know when she lay down with him, nor when she arose. But I guess he wasn't too drunk to do the dirty deed. So it came to pass in the morning that the firstborn now told her younger sister, look, I was there last night with dad, so let's get him drunk again tonight. You go in, you lie with him, so that we can preserve the seed of our father. Now, here's the place where I usually stop and say, wait a minute, whoa, whoa, whoa. Here's Lot. We're led to believe, and Lot doesn't seem to be talking, that Lot doesn't know what happened. But he's willing to let it happen again? Yeah. Okay, color me slightly skeptical of the level of righteousness we're seeing portrayed here. Anyway, dad was going for it again. They made their father drink wine that night also. This time the younger one goes in, lays with him, and again, he didn't know when she went in or when she came out. And thus, both of the daughters of Lot were with child. I guess they knew what time of the month it was, too, and planned their assault. So now they're pregnant. The first one bore a son. She called his name Moab. And we know about the Moabites. There is a long history of those in Scripture. The same as the father of the Moabites, it says unto this day. The younger one, she also bore a son, called his name Ben-Ami, son of my father. And that's the name of the children of Ammon, the Ammonites, unto this day. Chapter 20 tells about Abraham, who continues now to journey from there towards the land, heading south. And he dwelt between Kadesh and Shur, and sojourned in Gerar. And again, he does something that, got him in trouble, it would seem, or maybe saved him. It's kind of hard to tell, but regardless, he's going to do the very same thing one more time. He starts to tell people that his wife, Sarah, is in fact my sister. And now we have Abimelech, king of Gerar, who sent, and he literally took, Sarah, that same root word, lechach, there. But he didn't completely take her, I guess, is the way this one's going to read. The next few verses say that Elohim, in fact, came to Abimelech in a dream of the night, and he told him, look, here is why you're going to die, because of the woman you've taken. She is, in fact, married. You've committed adultery. She's a man's wife. Well, it says, Abimelech, my father, the king, had not come near her. And he says, Adoni, will you slay even a righteous nation? Didn't she tell me herself? Actually, no, this is he, the husband, Abraham. Didn't he say to me, she's my sister? And even she said, he's my brother. So both of them confirmed it. I got two witnesses for crying out loud. In the simplicity of my heart and in the innocence of my hands have I done this thing. And in the same dream, Elohim replies to him and he says, yep, I know that in the simplicity of your heart you did this. And for that reason, I withheld you from sinning against me and I didn't allow you to touch her. So, therefore, restore the man's wife. She is, in fact, his. He is, in fact, a prophet. He'll pray for you, and you can live. Now, that is, if you don't restore her, though, not so much. Know that you will surely die, you and everyone in your house, all that are yours. And I like this. This is one of those places where we see the Hebrew emphasis. It really, literally, it says mot tamot in the Hebrew. So we know mot is the root for die. You'll die. Mot. And in this case, it's literally, it's repeated. Mot tamot. And it translates, I like this translation, dying, you shall die. You're dead already. You're a dead man walking. Dying, you shall die, along with everybody that's in your house. So Abimelech gets the message. He got up early, got a hold of his servants, told them everything in their own hearing, and it scared the heck out of the men. Then he got Abraham, called him in and said, look, oh man, what have you done to us? And wherein did I ever sin against you that you brought on me and on my whole kingdom this great sin? You've done things to me that, you know, bud, shouldn't ought to have been done. What did you see that you have done this thing? So he asks Abraham a fair question. Now, I like the response here, and I find this response really, well, poignant, interesting, and certainly, let's just say, this year in particular, it kind of leaps off the page at me. Here's what Abraham says. Now, understand this, okay? We're talking about a pagan land and a pagan king, a guy who basically takes what he wants. No Me Too movement going on here. She can't say no. And yet, even Abimelech understands adultery, and he understands what it means to take somebody's wife. And what's Abraham going to tell him? Yeah, you would rather kill me. And I knew that. He says, because this is what I thought. The fear of Elohim is not in this place. I pause there, right? The reason I said this leaps off the page at me is because you think you could say that about America with a K, indeed about the entire stinking, and I use that term explicitly, world at this point? We got a whole lot of indications in the news on a daily basis that the fear of Elohim is not in this place. And he said, they'll slay me for the sake of my wife. Yeah, and by the way, he said, it's true. She really is my sister. She's the daughter of my father, not the daughter of my mother. She's my half-sister. And then she became my wife. And it came to pass that when Elohim caused me to wander from my father's house, I told her, here's what you need to do. This is the kindness you can show unto me. Every place where we come, you tell the folks, he's my brother. He ain't heavy, right? Abimelech then took some sheep, some oxen, men servants, women servants, and he gave the whole smash to Abraham. And he restored Sarah, his wife, back to him. And he said, look here, the whole land is before you. Dwell wherever you'd like to. And unto Sarah, he said the following. Look what, I've given your brother, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, it's for you a covering of the eyes to all that are with you, so that before all men you are righted. In other words, he's saying, I'm going to return your honor to you too. You know I didn't take it, but not everybody else does, so let's make sure. So it says, Abraham, remember, he was told, ask this man to pray for you. Abraham does. He prays unto Elohim, and Elohim healed Abimelech and his wife and his maidservants, and they all bore children. Because up until this point, for however long it was that Abraham was sojourning there, they had all essentially been barren, is the right word. The wombs had been closed because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Now, we know it can't be a whole long time because, no more than probably a year or so. Might have been a month or two until Sarah got pregnant. But it doesn't seem, at least to me. I guess it could have been a while longer, but not more than a year because that was exactly what the prophecy was, right? I'll come back next year about this time. So Yahuwah remembered Sarah as he'd said, and he did as he had spoken. And she too conceives. Now, what I find interesting, this is another one of those places where the Midrash adds a little bit to the text, so I'm always cautious about that. But I do find the kind of the moral of the story interesting here. And the moral of the story is said to be, this is a Rashi-ism, that Abraham has prayed for Abimelech, that his wives will be restored. And what happens? His own wife is, in fact, restored. In other words, he needs and gets exactly what he was praying for others. And the sages, of course, say, hey, that's an interesting lesson. I don't know that the lesson is provable, but the lesson is at least certainly consistent with what we see here, and so it's, I think, worth pointing out. So Sarah conceived. She bore Abraham a son in his old age, exactly at the set time at which Yahuwah had spoken, and he called the name of that son whom Sarah bore to him, Yitzchak. Isaac, if you will, in the English, but Yitzchak. And exactly as he had been commanded to do, remember, this sign through you and throughout your generations and your son that's born to you, he circumcised Yitzchak, Isaac, when he was 8 days old, as commanded. And then we're told Abraham was an even century mark. He was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Now, I love Sarah's line. Okay, and to my mind, folks, it's almost, every time I read this, it's a joyful line. This is great stuff. Sarah said, Elohim has made laughter for me. And this is actually pronounced, same root word, zikich, laughter for me. And everyone that hears this story will laugh on account of me. It's a prophetic understanding. It's a name. It's a name that literally is perfect in the situation, because it describes the prophecy, it describes the reaction, it describes the joy, and it describes, well, the character of the man who is going to bear this name. She says, furthermore, who would have said unto Abraham that Sarah would give his children suck? For I've now borne him a son in his own age, in his old age. Well, the child grew and was weaned. Abraham made a really big feast on the day that Yitzhak was weaned. And Sarah saw something that maybe she wished she hadn't seen. Well, maybe she did. But in any case, she saw something that should not have happened. She saw Hagar, son of the Egyptian son of Hagar, whom she'd born unto Abraham, making sport, mocking Yitzchak, Isaac. Now, guess what? What is the boy, the teenage boy, doing to the young boy who's just been weaned? Yep, same root word, Metzchak. He is laughing at him and laughing through him in a derogatory fashion. This is a pretty nasty, mocking kind of laughter, derisive, or perhaps it's even worse, maybe he's making sport in a way that is downright disgusting. There is no shortage of speculation, as you might guess, and I tend to think that probably given the reaction, no, it's not just he's laughing at the young boy, that there's more to this. But admittedly, there's a wide variety of opinion as to just how nasty what was going on was. And I still, though, can't necessarily disagree with those who suggest there's a sexual element or innuendo or understanding here. So she then goes to Abraham. She says, look, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman will not be an heir with my son, even with Yitzhak. And this thing, it says, was very grievous in Abraham's sight on account of his son. So again, here's another indication. This was pretty serious stuff. Mocking may or may not get it, but the kind of mocking that happened here was something that Abraham said, yep, you're right. Now, Elohim then has to speak to Abraham, and he says, let it not be grievous in your sight because of the lad, because of the bondwoman, in all that Sarah has said to you. Listen to her. In fact, hearken unto her voice, because it's Isaac that will be the one through whom your seed will come. Oh, and you know what? Understand this. The son of the bondwoman, he's repeating a promise that's already been made. I will also make a nation, because he is your seed. Abraham probably understood that. He, I have no doubt, remembered that. But we're going to get another reminder of it, a second witness. Yep. That still isn't going to change. So do, in fact, what it is that needs to be done here. So Abraham arose early in the morning. He took bread and a bottle of water. He gave it to Hagar. He put it on her shoulder, along with the child. In other words, the child was with her. And he sent her away. She headed out into the wilderness, Bamidbar, Beersheba. And the water in the bottle, pretty soon she was out of it. And she literally put the child under one of the shrubs, and she went down a little ways off from him, about a bow shot distance, and said, I don't want to see the death of the child. Let me not see it. And she sat over against him and lifted up her voice and wept. And Elohim, it says, heard the voice of the lad. Now, interestingly, right, you don't see this in English, but you do see it in the Hebrew, Ve-yish-mal. Actually, let me put it in two words, because it's literally two words. Ve-yishma el Ohim. You get it? Yishma el Ohim. Elohim heard the voice. That's the name of the man, Ishmael, right there in the prophetic understanding. As promised, Elohim, Yishmael, his voice. And the Malach of Elohim called out to Hagar, and she said, what's the problem? He said to her, what's the problem, Hagar? Do not fear. Fear not, for Yahuwah has heard the voice of the lad where he is. And it's interesting. I have this note in my margins, because I remember reading this and thinking, over and over here, it's the lad, the lad, the lad. And yet, so the name of the young man, teenager, doesn't appear in the verse, except for where it appears in the prophetic understanding. Arise, the angel continues, lift up the lad, hold him fast by the hand. I'm going to make out of him a great nation. So Elohim then opened her eyes, and behold, look over there, a well of water. So she went, she filled the bottle, she gave her son something to drink, and it says Elohim was with the lad, and he grew, and he dwelt in the wilderness, and he became an archer. In the wilderness of Paran he dwelt, and his mother got him a wife there out of the land of Mitzrayim, and it came to pass, right, this was her territory, came to pass that Abimelech and Phicol, captain of his host, spoke to Abraham again. There's good old Abimelech. Is this the same king? It could be a title, but probably it's the same fellow. Hasn't been all that long. And he says, look, you know what? Elohim is with you in all that you do. He's begun to figure that out. So therefore swear to me here before Elohim that you will not deal falsely with me, nor with my son or my son's son, but do according to the kindness that I, remember, that I did unto you, and to the land wherein you have sojourned. All right, says Abraham, I'll swear. And he reproved Abimelech, though, because of the well of water, which Abimelech's servants had violently taken away. He's not happy about what's been done to the wells. And Abimelech says, well, look, I don't know who did that. And you didn't tell me either. This is the first I've heard of it, just today. All right, okay. So Abraham took some sheep and some oxen. He gave them to Abimelech. And the two, it says, made a brit. They cut, literally, they karat a brit, a covenant. And Abraham set seven ewe lambs of the flock off. And he said, and Abimelech says to him, what do you mean by these seven ewe lambs that you set off? Behold, verily, yep, check it out, these seven ewe lambs shall take, you'll take them out of my hand. And that will be a witness to you, he's still worried about the well, that I have in fact dug this well. Okay, seems like that was the understanding, because the place then was called Beersheba, the well of seven, because both of them there swore. Now, here's where I'm going to make one more observation. This is one of those places where there's a whole lot of midrash on this. And let's just say it's not clear. I don't necessarily buy into the logic, but I do see that there's a pattern in Scripture. Okay, the pattern is that we see with Joshua, and we're told in Torah, and we certainly get it since then, make no treaty with the inhabitants of the land. So there are those that claim that Abraham made a mistake, in this case, by cutting that covenant. I don't believe Scripture says so explicitly, but it's certainly an interesting thing to kind of have in the back of your mind and ask, you know, the questions as we look at the rest of the patterns that play out here. So again, it's not one that I'm necessarily willing to sign up for, but I certainly do think about it, and as I read through it, you know, I keep it there and just ask, okay, is this or is this not what Abraham should have done? So they made the covenant, says in the next verse. Abimelech got up, along with Phicol, captain of his host. They went back to the land of the Philistines, and Abraham planted a tamarisk tree there at Beersheba, and there he called upon the name of Yahuwah, everlasting Elohim. And Abraham sojourned in the land of the Philistines for quite a while. Which brings us to probably, certainly the climax of this Torah portion. This is probably the portion that, in addition to being called Vayera, for those Hebrew words that begin it, and he appeared, is also called the Akida, or Akidah. You can pronounce it however you want. But it has to do, of course, with the binding of Isaac, is where the terminology comes from. So it says, it came to pass after these words, these Deborim, ha Deborim, these things, too, is another way to render that, that Elohim tested, proved Abram, now Abraham. It starts this way. He calls him. Abraham, he says. Hineni, here I am. And everybody that's probably ever read this knows the next line. Take your son, your only son whom you love, even Isaac, and head up, get yourself up into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains that I will tell you about when you get there. Now, here, of course, is a place where there's a lot of speculation. A lot of times I'll emphasize this. Tonight we're going to just tell the story, and we can come back and talk about some of the specifics later. I'm always, of course, happy to answer questions. And because we've talked about this in some detail in years past, I'm going to, like I said, just go through it tonight. But I have my own take on this. I certainly know people who say this is a really nasty thing. He had to do this. On the other hand, say others, simply because this is a picture of the offering of the Mashiach to come, arguably in this very same place, a long time later. But they don't give Abraham a pass as a general rule. What's going on here? And by the way, some people will take the creator of the universe to task and say, he's asking for human sacrifice. How dare he? That's out of character. It's inconsistent. You can't trust this Torah thing. He is not true to his... No. Okay, that's where I will stand up and say, okay, yeah, this is my take on it. Your mileage may vary. But I don't believe for a second that this man, Abraham, has any doubt about what's going to happen. He has been told, this son, and it's just in this same Torah portion, this is the son of promise. Through him, your seed will continue. Through him, all of the things that you have been promised, that you have trusted in your Creator and walked in obedience to him, all of these things will come to pass. Do we think, I can't believe for a second that Abraham has any doubt that whatever happens here, one thing is for sure. Isaac is the line, the son of promise, and he will somehow or other continue on. And I suspect that Abraham is kind of excited about this. I think he hadn't got a clue exactly how it's going to play out. He may have several ideas in his head, and he's probably curious which one is it going to be. But I read this story with excitement every year. If I put myself in Abraham's position, I'm thinking, oh boy, I can hardly wait to get to Moriah and do this, because I don't know what's going to happen, but it is going to be something that'll be, well, yeah, recorded in Scripture. This is going to be of biblical proportions, whatever is going to happen here, and I want to be part of it, and I want to see it, and I want my son Isaac to know about it. And I think he communicates that to Isaac. Listen as we go through the story and see if it doesn't make sense. Abraham gets up early in the morning, saddled his ass, took two of his young men with him, along with Isaac, his son. He cleaves some wood for the burnt offerings. He's got the firewood. He's got everything he needs. He rises up. He goes unto the place which Yahuwah had told him about. Took a while to get there. On the third day, he lifted up his eyes. There it is, quite a ways off. And Abraham then says to his young men, y'all stay here with the ass, and myself and the lad. Isn't that interesting? The lad, again. We're going to go up there. We'll worship. We'll come back to you. You notice, He doesn't say, I'll come back to you. He says, we'll come back to you. He uses the plural. Abraham took the wood, laid it upon Isaac, his son. So he's gonna have the young strapping boy here. He's not probably a strapping boy. He's probably in his 30s at this point. Anyway, he's going to have him carry the wood. I guess if I was 100 years old and I had a 30-year-old son, I'd probably have him carry the wood too. He took the fire in his hand along with the knife. So he's got a torch or he's got something ready to go for the fire. And they both went up together. Now, Isaac spoke to his father and he said, my father, Hineni, my son. Well, look, we got the fire here. We got the wood. But where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Le'olah, the lifted up, the burnt offering. And, of course, Abraham says these equally famous words. Elohim will provide himself, the lamb, for a burnt offering, my son. Obviously, there's some prophetic implications in that, and there's a clear understanding that Abraham knows what's going to happen. Again, I don't think he knows how it's going to happen, but he knows what's going to happen. And then we get this. Okay, he says, Elohim will provide himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. Isaac is happy with the answer. Abraham is not going to be able to get Isaac to go up that mountain if Isaac doesn't want to go. Literally, it's not going to happen. They're both in agreement, and that's exactly what the Hebrew says here. So they both of them went off together. They walked together. Can two walk together unless they're in agreement, right? They came to the place which Elohim told him about. Abraham built the altar there. He laid the wood in order. He bound Isaac, his son. Again, that's not going to happen unless Isaac allows himself to be bound. He laid him on the altar, right there on the wood, and he stretched forth his hand. He took the knife to slay his son. Here is a place where the timing is certainly open to some speculation. What happens precisely, right? How long does it take? Does the hand come down? When do these things occur? Well, what the text says is there is a malach of Yahuwah that calls out to him from Hashemayim, the heavens. This time it's twice. Abraham, Abraham. We know the answer, right? Here I am. Hineni. Abraham, Abraham, Hineni. Don't lay your hand on the lad, nor do anything to him. For now I see, I know, I yada. We have proven, not just to you and to me, which probably both of us understood your character up until this point, but now there's no doubt about it, and now we can write it down for all time. You did it. You are, in fact, an Elohim-fearing man, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Abraham lifted up his eyes. He looked. Sure enough, here is a ram caught in the thicket by the horns. He went and got the ram, and he offered him up instead, in the place of, as a substitution. Literally, the equation's balance is the way I like to think about this. There was a purpose in them going up here. Actually, there were multiple purposes. All are now fulfilled. There is, in fact, an offering, and it's a substitutionary offering of the lamb, the ram, exactly as Abraham had told his son. Elohim will provide himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son, and indeed that's true. And then Abraham called the name of that place, Yahuwah Yireh, the mount in which Yahuwah is seen. That root word, ra, there, to see, right? Yahuwah Yireh, where Yahuwah is seen. But we're not done yet. The malach of Yahuwah calls unto Abraham a second time out of the heavens. And he says, by myself have I sworn, says Yahuwah, because you've done this thing, you've not withheld your son, your only son, that in blessing I will bless you, and in multiplying, I will multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is upon the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because what you have hearkened, you have shamarred to my voice. So Abraham went, he returned with his young men, and they rose up, they went back to Beersheba, and Abraham stayed there, he dwelt at Beersheba. And it came to pass after all these things that it was told to Abraham, hey, guess what? Milcah. She, remember her? She has borne children to your brother Nahor, Uz, his firstborn, Buz, his brother, Kemuel, the father of Aram, and Chesed, and Hazo, Pildash, Yidlaf, and Betuel. We're getting a list of people, all born unto Abraham's brother, this fellow Nahor. Well, what's the point? Well, it says Bethuel begot Rebecca, in some renderings. And all of these eight did Milcah bear to Nahor, Abraham's brother. Now, this is where the Torah portion ends, but of course, it's important that we're seeing what's been set up here. The wife that is going to be the wife of Yitzhak, through whom all these promises that we've just been reminded of are going to come, is now being laid out for us right at the end of the portion. It turns out Nahor also had a concubine whose name was Reumah. She bore Teba and Gaham and Tahash and Ma'akah as well. So all of these are going to be important. Nahor has a couple of wives, and she has, and he's got eight through one, and a concubine that has, looks like, four more. Which takes us to the end of the Torah portion. It's also going to basically take us to the last we're going to hear about Sarah, because the next portion is going to be Chaye Sarah, the life of Sarah, and indeed the end of the life of Sarah.